12:12, this is WGN, and you are listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. We do this weekdays from noon to 1. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We're rolling along until 1. Anna Gavlantis will come by and entertain and inform and improve your life. That'll be at 1 o'clock here on WGN Radio. We start the Wintrust Business Lunch today with John Najarian, the founder of MarketRebellion.com, the financial news, education, and subscription site. Thanks for joining us, John. How are you today?
I'm doing well, John. Thank you and Peter very much for having me on again.
Chicago Tribune's got a headline today. Second stimulus check updates, minor progress reported. There's another headline I saw, though, and it said a line in the sand. This is from the Tribune. Neither side has budged from their positions, with Democrats demanding an extension of the $600 per week supplemental unemployment benefit. I guess that's the big sticking point right now, huh?
That is, as we understand it anyway. We did see a report from Bloomberg just maybe an hour and a half ago that said they thought they were a lot closer to a deal. I think both sides are going to have an awful lot of pressure on them from their constituencies. Doesn't matter, Republican or Democrat, they're going to be pushing hard on these folks to get a deal done rather than just to grandstand. Because we, you know, if I asked you right now, John, I bet you'd tell me there's a 90%+ chance that we're going to see some sort of stimulus. And it's probably greater than 200, but probably less than 600. If they do stick with 600, and there is no flexibility, then, I'd say that's an outlier chance of maybe 5%, at most 10%, that they would basically cut their noses off to spite their faces, because it won't matter which side you're on. If you, rather than giving anything, say it's 600 or nothing, I think both sides lose.
Yeah, I won't argue with you on that. Later in this piece, it says Pelosi said she would consider reducing the $600 benefit for people in states with lower unemployment rates. With lower unemployment rates. It didn't say lower unemployment benefits. It would seem to me like whatever state you're in, if you're unemployed, you're unemployed. Doesn't matter if your state has maybe got a low rate, although perhaps you could try and go find another job. But that's been the problem that, say, Elise Glink pointed out to us yesterday. For the people who are maybe disincentivized to go back to work because the benefit is so generous, I'm putting quotes around that, there, for a lot of people, are not jobs to go back to, John.
Right. Well, and I'm sure, John, that you saw those, horrifying stats out of New York that said a third of all businesses that close in New York will not reopen. That is terrible, obviously, for those people that worked there, for the people that depended on those businesses, even if they were somewhat of a luxury item, as some probably were. It's nonetheless terrible because it changes the character of the city when you don't have some of those businesses, you know, whether it's an ethnic restaurant, whether it's even something that people have come to depend on to make their life a little easier. I don't understand how we can stay shut down as long as we have and not have that impact. However, it's just one of those sad consequences of locking us down.
Talk to me about some stocks you're looking at, some companies, and why are they making news? It's 12:19 on the Wintrust Business Lunch with John Najarian at MarketRebellion.com. What companies are making news today, John?
Well, during this entire pandemic, whenever there's a bit of good news about a company that's either doing COVID testing or vaccines and therapies, obviously, that stock, John, is going to get a lot of investor interest. And today it's Sorrento. It's not the first time for Sorrento. The symbol is SRNE. But this was a $2 stock when COVID really started hitting. And they have a fast COVID test that has really got this stock moving. Today it's up let me see, 26%. That's over $12.30 a share. Like I say, this stock was $2 when COVID was really getting going. And now because of the advancements they're making towards getting these tests widely distributed and so forth, their test, they're one of many that has the testing. Again, this is not a vaccine, but nonetheless, this is huge for that stock. And obviously, hockey and basketball, to a much lesser extent, baseball, have really been depending on these tests to basically play within those bubbles in the case of hockey and basketball, and testing the players out on the field will be a big part about getting sports back, not just on the screen with nobody in the stands, but hopefully at some point in the not-too-distant future, John, people in the stands as well.
Yeah.
And Sorrento's certainly going to benefit from that.
Goldman Sachs, speaking of sports, I see, has raised its price target on Dick's Sporting Goods to $50 per share from $40 per share. They think that they're going to do pretty well in their next earnings report and that their sales are approaching pre-COVID numbers. That's not sales. That's the stock price. The stock is already trading back near pre-COVID highs. I can imagine why. Seems to me like if you can get the stuff, you are interested in the stuff. Everybody seems to be looking for a way to exercise or recreate at home or on their own, and that's what Dick's does.
Exactly. The part of their business, I think, that spooked a lot of us, and I'm not an investor right now in Dick's, but the part that spooked us was how many teams rely on getting equipment from Dick's. Now, that's only part of their business, I'll grant you, John, but nonetheless, you know, with all of the little leaguers and so forth that aren't playing, because most of the country, it's very restrictive on things like that, or football, or lacrosse, or any of the other sports that might be played, many of which have been pushed off, as you know, and as you've reported, to the spring from this coming fall. Some of those that were fall sports have been kicked into the spring. That is hurting many of these folks, Hibbett Sports, Foot Locker, and Dick's Sporting Goods. But on the other hand, you do have an awful lot of us that are wearing out our equipment that we use to try to get ourselves in shape, and we're relying on those three names. So I don't disagree with Goldman on the call here.
I went to play it against sports the other day because I couldn't get what I wanted, and I thought they were pretty busy. I don't know if that's a publicly traded company, but it would seem to me like they fall nicely into that sector, folks trying to save money, trying to recreate. Played against sports, had a crowd of people, and they had a lot of things that some of the stores I was looking at didn't have, like bicycles. You know, some of them were old ratty ones, some of them were brand new ones, but if you needed a bicycle, Play It Again had them. And if I may,
oh my gosh, yeah. And are you right about that? Bicycles sold out nearly everywhere and or trading at premiums, because the people that assemble the bikes, not just the demand for them, you know, you cut the supply down and the demand remains the same or the demand increases. You and I know what happens then, John. Either prices have to go up or you can't get whatever it is that you are out there trying to get. And I think that's playing out across the country in RVs and in boats as well. You just can't find enough of these types of things that people want because they are uncomfortable getting on an airplane maybe, and instead they want to be in an RV and go see America or whatever that way without staying in hotels and so forth. RVs sold out. Camping World, stock exploding, all of those sorts of things.
I was, if I may, just do one other shout-out to Best Buy the other day. I needed to get a speaker. There was an article in the Tribune about home movie theaters. You can't go to theaters. People are buying projectors to project, say, a large image of a movie from Netflix on a wall in your backyard or a screen that you had set up. I wanted to get a speaker to go with a little projector that we had bought online. Amazon shipped it to us or somebody did, but we needed a speaker. And when you go there, again, they stand you 6 feet increments under a tent. When my experience was a little different than the first time I went there, but this time they said, you can't go in the store. We're doing no in-store shopping. An associate meets you out there. You tell them what you want. they go in, explore what they have, come back and report to you. He said, we have three different kind of speakers, and he brought with him the middle-priced one, described it to me, and I said, that sounds pretty good. He said, great. I gave him my card. He went in, came back out with a receipt. I did not sign anything. I didn't touch him. There was the only thing we shared was the box and the credit card. But I guess my point is, it was efficient, and it was very thought out, and I just felt so good about my purchase. I think the downside for them was there weren't hundreds of us wandering around the store making impulse buys. Maybe I would have thrown something else in the cart, but that was a very well-executed purchase on my part, and I think on theirs too, John.
Absolutely, and what you've just described is why Best Buy is trading at 52-week highs. I mean, there are only a handful of retailers that can make that claim, even after the riots emptied some of their stores in the biggest cities. They were just, you know, basically hit upon very hard. Nonetheless, the fact that they have found a way to deal with consumers like yourself, like me, I've purchased a lot of things at Best Buy and have been delighted with the experience, but I haven't been in the store once in the last 5 months. Like you say, this is just a great way to address how we shop now.
What was your thought about the president saying that he's going to shut TikTok down for U.S. users unless an American company buys them?
From people that I talked to in the, not necessarily spy industry, but in the cybersecurity, they think that there are a myriad of backdoors and dangerous parts of TikTok. As long as it's run by the Chinese. So I think that would be a good idea. I don't think the president's idea of the U.S. getting paid for basically being the investment banker or whatever he thinks that we might be for that sale, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I've never heard of anybody even proposing anything like that before. But I do think it's a good idea to get things like backdoor spyware off of kids' phones, our phones. I know in government and in most security, they will not let people have TikTok on their phones for the fear that everything on that phone could be compromised.
One last stock for you to comment on. DocuSign.
All right.
DocuSign is also doing well, and I guess for obvious reasons, huh?
Yes. This is just like Zoom or like Chegg, or like any of the companies, you know, that basically benefit from not having to be in front of people. You know, most of us miss those days when we had to be in front of people. But there are a lot of companies like this one that have now accelerated the adoption dramatically, John. The shutdown accelerated that adoption. Banks, credit unions, virtually everybody has had to start accepting signatures over DocuSign rather than the hard signature done in front of a notary or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think this, it's a great service. I don't know if it continues to justify the multiple that it has at a $41 billion valuation, but nonetheless, it's a big beneficiary of the shutdown.
They say that's the value of DocuSign, the company?
$41 billion. Yes, sir.
They're not making tractors here. I mean, it's an
no, they're not.
It's ones and O's. That's amazing. Wow. Huh. John Najarian, MarketRebellion.com, the financial news, education, and subscription site. That's MarketRebellion.com. Thanks for your time today, John.
Always. Thank you, John.
12:35. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Joe Wasco's on a phone line, the Chief Sales and Marketing Officer at Optimal Design. This is a technology innovative firm that specializes in a number of things, some of which I don't even understand, Joe. So why don't you give me the elevator speech? What does your company do?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me, John. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
Optimal Design, we're an engineering and product development firm. What that means is we design products, many of which, you know, you've probably used, whether it be a mobile phone or a wearable, a smartwatch. And we do a lot of different products for many companies right here in Chicagoland, actually. And it's all about technology, right? It's the development of a tablet or of a piece of equipment that's used for monitoring, like a smart city or a smart grid or things of that nature. So a lot of it revolves around, you know, helping companies, a lot of them Fortune 500 type companies in the Chicagoland area, and also, you know, nationwide, with developing new products, new technology that are used both in the consumer and industrial fields.
But you're not the manufacturer of these things, so somebody comes up with a better widget, and then they say, how does it work, or how will it look, how do we interface with it, and then they turn to you. Is that it?
That's correct, yeah. So many of these companies will they'll have an idea, and either they need help implementing it, or maybe it's outside of their area of expertise, and they're looking for some assistance with maybe integrating some new technology. I mean, for instance, like 5G, right? 5G is becoming, it's just starting to launch. It's going to be a very big growth area for the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. And a lot of big corporations are going to be wanting to integrate 5G into their products, and we're here to help them do that. We don't actually manufacture the products and sell them, but what we do is we help our clients develop the product, and then we also will do some assembly work and some of the manufacturing just for the early units here, right here in Huntington Heights, and then eventually we'll transfer that to one of their factories or one of their manufacturers.
Yeah, you guys are in Arlington Heights. How many folks do you all employ then, Joe?
We have about 60 engineers and designers split between our Arlington Heights headquarters, and we also have an office right downtown, just real close to Union Station.
I saw VR development, virtual reality development is on your resume. So what is that? I have a clue what that means, but tell me how you're working in that field.
Oh, yeah. So we actually partnered with a company very early on. They had, back in 2015, had an idea for a virtual reality experience. And we helped develop all the technology that went into it. So it is probably the most advanced virtual reality system that you as a consumer can go and interface with. It's not something for the home. You actually go to a location like Disney. They're at Disney World. They're in Las Vegas. So there are these locations you go. You pay $30 and you put on all this gear that allows you to transport yourself to a different world and really interface. You know, virtual reality is all about, you know, putting graphics in front of your eyes, but you can't really touch and feel. And the difference here is when you put this gear on, you can actually interface with your surroundings. You can actually touch and feel people. You can touch and feel the world around you, and it is different, right? You can be transported to, you know, onto a starship or something of that nature. So it's one of the things, especially in the world we live in today, to remove yourself from reality and go do something else and take your mind off what you're going through. It's a phenomenal type experience.
So then what part of that system did your company provide?
So we did everything from the look and the feel of all the gear you put on to engineering. I mean, engineering all of the technology. So it's the electrical engineering, all the software development. We actually manufacture all of the gear right here in Arlington Heights for this client.
Wow.
So it's called The Void. This has been a great opportunity for our organization, just because, you know, it's cutting edge technology that we got to get in front of and be a part of and really utilize a lot of the top talent we have here in Chicago.
Joe Wasco's on a phone line. You know, one of the articles about you guys said that if you have a dilemma with your product, then these are the people to turn to. And I'm starting to get the feel for that. The Chief Sales and Marketing Officer for Optimal Design. Just one last thing about this little tangent we're on, virtual reality. Does the industry worry that the experience will seem so real that people will injure themselves or something like that? I imagine that I was on a whitewater raft and I was doing a virtual reality experience, and I'm not going to be in Colorado whitewater rafting, but if you could make me feel like I was doing that, that would be swell, except I'd probably hit myself against the wall or wherever it is that I'm experiencing this, you know?
Sure, yeah, and it's all about when that experience is developed, is, you know, making sure that, that all the right safety precautions are put in place and ensuring that, you know, you can't get hurt. Because, yes, you're right. If you're in your home and you're not properly set up, you definitely can hurt yourself. Yeah, there's some very new we've got some big announcements being made with one of our new clients around virtual reality that's getting ready to launch. And it's very high profile. We're excited. Definitely need to stay tuned for that in the coming months. But it's a really cool adrenaline-type virtual reality experience that's coming out next.
Okay, well, that's the invitation to have you back. By the way, just one last thing. Has the pandemic affected your business, or are you sufficiently tech that you've been insulated from some of this?
No, John, that's a great question. So, you know, the diversity of the products that we work on has really helped us throughout this pandemic. You know, some of our clients have seen a big downturn, and therefore we see kind of a decrease in business from them. Some of those clients are like in beauty tech, and, you know, beauty and has taken a pretty big hit with less people putting on makeup and purchasing, you know, beauty products. So we've seen that kind of decrease. But on the other side, we've seen other clients just booming right now. For instance, more people are at home. More people are grilling. We do a lot of work within developing new technology around grills. And so that's just one parallel to show that, you know, where one industry may be down, the other one is doing well, and we've been able to successfully navigate that. And take advantage of it just due to the diversity of the type of products that we're capable of working on.
How about that? Joe Wasko, Chief Sales and Marketing Officer, Optimal Design. Here's the website, OptimalDesignCo.com. OptimalDesignCo.com. We'll have you back, Joe, when you can spill the beans on that other virtual experience you were talking about.
Definitely. Thank you, John.
Yeah, I appreciate you joining us. It's 12:42. Okay, Steve Bertrand, catch us up on some business news.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. There's been a move in recent years to use public pictures on the web to build a huge database of faces to help improve facial recognition systems. Well, now researchers at the University of Chicago are working on a system to thwart that. A team of computer engineers has developed a tool that disguises the pictures with pixel-level changes that confuse facial recognition systems. U.S. aviation regulators have proposed a long list of fixes for Boeing's grounded 737 MAX. It's one of the most extensive sets of requirements the agency has issued after an accident. In addition to the fixes specific to the systems implicated in the accident, it would mandate broad computer changes to improve reliability, among other things. And so how bad is it for Chicago businesses? Yelp recently went over the numbers. It says about 4,400 Chicago area businesses have closed during the pandemic, and more than half of them say they won't reopen. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Thank you, Steve. Over to you, Orion. What have you got?
Okay, we take a look at agricultural products prices today at noon, and I think they're reflecting the weekly crop reports of yesterday. But let's look at the numbers first of all. The September wheat contract is down 11.5 cents. September corn down 8.25 cents. And the August soybeans down 16.25 cents a bushel. Checking the livestock trade at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the October lean hog contract is up 57 cents a hundredweight, but the August live cattle contract down 70 cents, and the August feeder cattle contract down just 5 cents a hundredweight. But the weekly crop conditions yesterday continued to point toward very favorable weather for development of the crop. Corn crops, 76% of the nation's corn acres, good to excellent condition. Illinois, 76%, Indiana, 67%, Iowa, 73%, and Wisconsin with 72%. And 73% of the nation's soybean crop in good to excellent condition. 66% in Illinois, 68% in Indiana, 73% in Iowa, but Wisconsin, 87% of the soybean crop in good to excellent condition. and the barometer for the health of agriculture from the Purdue University CME Group showed the sentiment of farmers in this country virtually unchanged in July compared to a month earlier. The index rose just 1 point from June to a reading of 118. That's still 30% lower than in February. And although there was little change in the July barometer, producers' perspective on current future conditions shifted. The index of current conditions rose 12 points from June to a reading of 111. And another interesting part of that survey, over half of the farmers responding to the July survey said they were less likely to attend in-person educational events in 2020 as a result of the concerns over COVID-19. And although overall farmer sentiment in July did not change much compared to June, sentiment was still much weaker than in February before the impact of the pandemic hit. July farmers indicated they were a bit less concerned about the current economic situation on their farms than earlier this spring. And finally, a look at our main competitor in the soybean world, Brazil. Brazilian soy production will hit a record 132.6 million tons next season, thanks to demand from China that remains strong and farmers in Brazil with the intent to expand acreage. That's according to their survey program called StoneX. StoneX predicts that Brazil will expand soybean plantings to a record 94 million acres in the current marketing year. And StoneX estimates that Brazilian farmers harvested 122.8 million tons of soybeans in the past year. That's your Money on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us to report on business here on WGN. Where do we start, Amy? Jets or pot? Which one strikes your fancy?
Let's start with airlines. There's a lot of news there. Since March of 2019, Boeing 737 MAX aircraft has been grounded, and there have been many stop-start, many hopeful comments from Boeing and some less hopeful ones from FAA administrators. It's triggered the kind of an overhaul of the way a lot of planes are certified. There's been a lot to this story. And this news today is that the FAA has issued a 36-page document that details a whole variety of fixes and trainings and things like that that Boeing needs to do in order to get this plane certified. And it's one of the longest lists that's ever been issued following an accident. So Boeing executives said some of it was surprising, but for the most part, most of what is on it have been things that have previously been surfaced as concerning. A lot of it is things that directly were involved in the two crashes that led to the death of 346 people back before led to the plane being grounded. But some of them were things that regulators later said, you know, these were kind of shortfalls of the plane all along that we need to fix while we're doing this. So it's open for public comment, which they legally can avoid doing if they want, but they are better served, I think they've all decided, by having it open for public comment. There will be a second phase of that. So then pilot training will be done, and there's another public comment period on that for the pilot training. So this doesn't mean that the 737 MAX is going to start flying tomorrow. Still, at earliest, this is looking like October. But this is a very, very important moment for Boeing, of course, based here locally, who has really endured a lot of hardship even leading up to the pandemic and even leading up to, you know, the travel industry's major pain caused by COVID-19.
Are they saying that these 36 pages of recommendations or proposed fixes for Boeing for the 737 MAX, is it software or is it hardware? Are they having to rewire things or are they just changing code?
It's a lot of things. There are some wires that they do feel they were specifically named as these wires that needed to be rerouted and changed their position to be more, you know, in line with safety procedures, things like that, that weren't already meeting safety rules. There's a light, and the light has been kind of the center of conversation. This light, from what I understand, does many functions in an aircraft for different types of alerts. And this was apparently not operating as it should have been, which is not to say it malfunctioned. It isn't necessarily, wasn't necessarily queued up to operate in an alert capacity in those two fatal crashes, according to investigations. So one part of that is it will be much more clear if there is any issue going on to pilots. But also with that, flight crew will be retrained, because part of what was that issue in the grounding was it was overestimated how flight crews would react
right.
in the event of a malfunction.
Right. Yeah, I seem to remember being a combination of both. Maybe there were some software issues, but it was also the pilot's inability to override the software, this software's inability to accept the override from the human beings. Also,
that's right.
Illinois weed sales set a record in July. I don't know if I should be surprised by this or not, given all we're going through.
I know. I had the same reaction. But interestingly, we had a pretty big month in June. We already had a pretty record-breaking month there in June, which was, you know, up $47.6 million. Everybody was very, you know, talking about that quite a bit, of calling this as, okay, here's this very big early success. And now in July, we're looking at $60.9 million. That's according to figures from the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation. So $60.9 million, that's quite a bit. When we look at how this data tracks over since it became legalized in January, we saw a little bit of a dip early. So a lot of that was kind of novelty. There were plenty of people on that first day saying, and that first week saying, I don't even necessarily use this. I just kind of want to be part of this moment. So there was that. There was the novelty buyers. And then what we saw was supply and demand weren't quite tracking together. There was a lot of people buying marijuana in various forms, but the suppliers had not yet caught up with what they could sell to recreational users. They had to supply to medical users first. So, you know, there was a little bit of that, and they were kind of nervous, hey, we may not be able to keep up with demand until, like, March, April. Now that that's kind of solved, there's some other dispensaries open. There's some issues that are starting to be ironed out. There's still some miles ahead, but some of them are starting to be ironed out. We're seeing a lot of growth from this, which is interesting because this was rolled out so quickly. You know, this became legal only 6 months after that vote, which is in some states it has been, you know, a much longer rollout.
Yeah.
So some people kind of felt like we were going to be kind of caught flat-footed, and they were worried we wouldn't have the supply for months and months and months. But, you know, it seems like things have caught up and they're going to keep growing. And that's a huge number. 60.9 million is quite a lot.
Still plenty of lines at the neighborhood pot shop where I live, I'll say that. Amy.
Yeah, and there were some issues with, you know, how they could keep the retail establishments open. They were considered essential businesses, so they were never closed. But there were some, you know, some protocol issues about how to serve medical marijuana patients that maybe had compromised immune systems. So they had kind of curbside pickup, and they had things like that that slowed them down a little bit, too. And that kind of compounded the slowdown. But, you know, I think it'll be really interesting to see what this does in the next couple of months, and then to look back in January, February, look at the year data to kind of tell the story of how this performed in its first year.
Amy Guth following all of that. Thanks, Amy. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks, John.